opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Prairie Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.
All righty, folks. It's time for another installment of Our Veteran Community on KCIW 100.7 LPFM from Brookings, Oregon, the hub of whale watching 2020. Any rate, I like to change the promos up a little bit every time. So today we have Bill Upton across from me in the studio, and we're going to be talking about Bill's life and, you know, what his experiences in the military have been, and I welcome you aboard, Bill.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Yeah, I understand that your military experience is more recent than a lot of the vets I've had on. You were in the Middle East in what campaign?
I was in the United States Navy from 87 to 91, so it was Desert Shield.
Desert Shield. I always get them confused. Storm Shield, you know.
It was the precursor to the storm.
Yeah, okay. Very good. Well, we're going to get to that eventually, but we're going to go take the Wayback Machine to where Bill was born. So give me some history as to where you were born and your upbringing.
I was born in Mariposa, California, outside of the Yosemite National Park. Down in the Gold Rush country.
Yeah, beautiful country. I used to live all around there, and it's a great area.
My father retired CDF, California Department of Forestry, after 34 years.
Right.
And my mom was a school bus driver.
All right. Cool deal. So you got to be chauffeured every now and then, right?
Once in a while.
Very good. So what was your first school that you attended?
I would have to say it was probably Forest Hill Elementary in Forest Hill, California.
Okay, very good. And you were there for all, what, 7, 8 grades or 6 grades or whatever?
I was there to freshman year of high school.
Oh, okay, great. So any fond memories from that educational experience?
Just time spent on the river gold panning.
Ah, that's cool. That's cool. Now, did you have other classmates that liked to do that kind of stuff, or?
No, it was pretty much my dad and I kind of together thing.
Yeah, that's a neat bonding experience. A lot of kids don't get a chance to spend that much time with their parents doing specific events and things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And how many kids in the family?
I have one little sister.
A little sister. Okay. So was she ever a part of the gold panning excursions?
No, or? Not really.
No.
She was the bookworm.
Oh, I see. you were the out in nature boy, and she was the bookworm, huh?
Yes.
Cool deal. So I know we all have our stories about hijinks that we got involved with in school. Do you have any of those that you care to share about, given the fact that the time of limitations is already up?
No, not really. Just grew up in Susanville, where I went to high school.
Okay.
Over in Northern California, after my dad transferred through work.
Okay.
And learning to drive in the snow and ice.
Ah.
So that was fun and challenging.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I go through, on my way to Tahoe, drive through Susanville, take that route. It's an interesting town. It's kind of like out in the middle of nowhere. And very rural, as far as that goes. I don't know that they've got any kind of industry going on there whatsoever. What was the big claim to fame in Susanville when you were growing up?
Well, there was a sawmill there at one time.
Ah, yeah.
Back in the mid-80s.
Okay.
But there's always been the prison.
Right.
That's...
Yeah, the main focus of employment in that area. Yeah. So, was it a pretty... good town for a young guy to be growing up in?
If you like outdoors.
Right.
You know, there was plenty of fishing and hunting and whatnot, but other than that, no.
No, yeah. That's the drawback. I grew up in a small town that basically had a bowling alley and a theater, and that was about it, unless you like to get out and you know, do fishing or go pheasant hunting, that kind of stuff. So very, very outdoor oriented. Did you take up fishing or hunting at all?
I did. Yeah. I did. Eagle Lake was close by.
Uh-huh.
And it's famous Eagle Lake trout. The average trout's about 3 pounds.
Wow. That makes a nice dinner.
So, yeah, it was pretty enjoyable.
Yeah. Very cool. So you graduated from high school there, right?
Yes.
Okay. Now, did you immediately enlist into the Navy or?
I pre-enlisted.
Oh, okay.
I was enlisted when I was still in high school. So I had to wait until after high school was over. Or I graduated, and then right. I went into the military shortly after.
Yeah, so you kind of had a career course set up ahead of time to go into that service?
I did.
Uh-huh.
But then I didn't. I was kind of, I don't know how you would say, coerced into going in there.
Okay.
My uncle had a heart attack,
mm-hmm.
and he was my fishing partner.
Gotcha.
And so my bond with him was to go into the military to learn how to operate boats.
Oh, okay.
So that we could have a commercial fishing boat and still fish together.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you why you chose the Navy. Well, there's the answer, you know. So you were aboard much bigger boats than a regular fishing boat, though.
I was. Yeah. I was.
Yeah.
Had I known now what I knew, didn't know then, I would have probably tried to go into the Seabees to where I could have been in on a tugboat or a smaller boat.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I was on stationed on the USS Harry E. Arnell, guided missile cruiser out of Norfolk, Virginia.
Yeah, that's how many, what was the crew capacity on that?
I think it was 450 people.
So it's, yeah. A lot of folks in a small space.
Pretty much.
Crazy. So what were the first days of your military induction like? From showing up at boot camp and all that kind of stuff.
Shell-shocked.
Okay.
You know, here I come from rural Nowhereville.
Yeah.
And put into barracks with a bunch of other guys.
Uh-huh.
And kind of... like I said, it was awakening.
Yes, yes.
To be told you have to get up now. This is when you eat. This is when you shower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So the rigidity of the program just slapped you in the face. Huh?
Exactly.
Okay. So during boot camp, were you assigned any specific job responsibilities or? You know, I don't know how that works. I was never in the military, so.
Well, we had our daily assignments.
Uh-huh.
One person or two people would do watch and whatnot like that while the other people were out doing drills.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody took turns on their chores.
Okay, kind of like an equal opportunity abuser.
Exactly.
Now, were your, what do they call them in the Navy? I know in the Army they're called drill instructors, but...
they were the same, drill instructors.
Drill instructors. How are those guys in general? I mean, I know we have this image of the hardcore, you know, yelling in your ear and all that kind of stuff. Was it as intense as that, or...
At times.
Okay.
They were decent fellows.
Yeah.
But... I think that, like anybody, you need to be loud
mm-hmm.
to get their point across or to conform.
Right. Yeah, sometimes it takes a little bit of volume to get through the thick noggin, huh?
Exactly.
How diverse was the ethnic makeup of the group that you were in? I mean, were there a lot of different folks from big cities and little towns and all that stuff?
There was. There was... a mix of everything.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Big city and rural.
Right.
And trying to understand each other was a challenge.
I bet. Not, well, I mean, obviously you've got regional dialect and stuff like that, but I guess slang was part of the thing to be overcome, especially if you're talking about people from big cities and stuff like that.
Pretty much.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just diversity, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Coming from small town California.
Right.
To the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you think that that exposure ultimately benefited you in the long run?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
It did.
Okay. I met some guys that said, you know, I could have done without that, but, you know, sometimes it's a tough way to accomplish that worldwide knowledge is in different people and cultures and things like that. So how long was training camp for you guys, boot camp?
I think ours was 12 weeks or 13 weeks.
Okay. So what does that get you prepared to do?
Mind.
Your mind. Behave, young man, behave.
To the ability to follow orders and direction of leadership.
Okay. All right.
They tried to give us as much leeway as they could in my division.
Mm-hmm.
We were the flag unit of graduation.
Okay.
Our drill instructors gave us the freedom to march ourselves to and from lunch, to and from the dining hall,
mm-hmm.
which was uncommon.
Oh. So you got to be unescorted, basically, because you guys proved that, you know, you could actually be responsible.
Yes.
Basically, okay. Now, I know a lot of the services, you have the opportunity for further training after basic. So is that something that they offered to the guys in your unit?
Had I known, again, before I went in, I would have probably picked a different field.
Mm-hmm.
But being that I went in as a deck seaman.
Okay.
So that I could operate the ship. It was pretty much the bottom of the
pool, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Now, when you say run the ship, I mean, what aspects of the ship's functions were you able to learn?
Actually, as the deck seaman, we were responsible for painting the exterior of the ship,
mm-hmm.
and all of the handrails and guardrails, the small boat.
Okay. So that was like a 365 day a year job, basically, because by the time you get down at one end, it's time to go where you began first.
Exactly.
like a mobile Golden Gate Bridge, so to speak.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
But also one of our duties was on the bridge,
mm-hmm.
actually standing watch and operating the helm and the lee helm.
Okay. Right.
So that was the challenging part for me,
right?
Personally, because I got to be on the bridge with the captain and the XO,
uh-huh.
and steer the ship, what I always wanted to do.
Yeah, well, that's great, because that talent, that skill, you know, skill set can be transferred to fishing boats.
It can.
Now, did you ever, while you were up there, and it's been a significant amount of time, were you ever privy to conversations between the XO and the officers that people would might be surprised about or would be interesting to talk about?
I would have to say several, but nothing that would be of importance.
Okay, yeah. So it wasn't all business all the time necessarily.
Pretty much it was business all the time.
Was it? Okay. Yeah, I was wondering if they, you know, had jokes amongst themselves and things like that. So I'm just looking for, you know, a little human input on that. But, you know, hey, you are in a, you know, a ship of battle. And you got to keep your head screwed on straight, and taking a focus of attention off that can end up in disastrous results, I'm sure.
It can.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so you've made it through basic, okay? When you first shipped it, well, how did you find out what ship you were going to be on?
When I was the last week of boot camp, mm-hmm. they gave us our orders of where we would be stationed.
Mm-hmm.
And I got mine, and lo and behold, it said, you're going to Virginia.
Hmm.
So here's a guy from California being shipped to the East Coast.
Yeah. Where did you do your basic at?
I did my in San Diego.
In San Diego, okay. Yeah, so you stayed on the West Coast all the way until finding out what ship you're going to be put on. Now, within the Navy, are there better or more desirable ships to be stationed on than others?
Oh, I'm sure just like anything, there's always a better.
Right.
The grass is always greener on the other side of the fence.
I want to be on an aircraft carrier. Yeah, but that's still a pretty exciting ship to be on, a guided missile, you know, cruiser. So
yeah, well, when I first got back to Virginia,
right,
and showed up to the ship, it was in dry dock.
Okay.
So it was lime green from the keel to the mast.
Oh.
In full retro.
Right.
And so we spent the first 6 months working on making the ship seaworthy again.
Okay.
When we finally did get out of dry dock, they turned us into the North Atlantic Admiral Fleet ship.
Oh, okay.
So we were the top ship of the East Coast.
Wow. Now, there's an honor and a responsibility there.
It was.
Yeah, yeah. So you think that inferred more attention to detail because you were the kind of like the centerpiece of the
most fleet? Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most definitely.
Okay, so everybody had to really have their stuff squared away, and the ship had to look shipshape all the time, and there was no lax period. Now, during your basic, you know, we're bouncing back and forth. How much time did you spend on the ships out at sea?
During basic?
Yeah, during basic.
None.
So you went basically from a land lubber to a six-month get the ship in shape, and then you're on the ocean.
Exactly.
What was the adjustment of being at sea like for you?
You know, we first pulled out, and it was pretty calm seas.
Mm-hmm.
Myself, I was sick as a dog for the first 3 days.
Yeah.
And it was very calm and seas.
Yeah.
But then after that, we could go through hurricanes, and I never got sick.
Interesting.
So it was,
the
you know.
Body adjusted, yeah. Yeah.
Kind of fortunate, I guess, for that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So myself, the adjustment was quite easy.
Yeah. Okay. Now, was it as easy when you went ashore? You had your sea legs, and then all of a sudden, you have to develop land legs again. What was the adjustment on that like? For some guys, it was like really horrible.
It didn't seem to make much difference either way.
Oh, okay. Well, you were a lucky one. That's good. That's good. Now, most of our listening audience, unless you've been in the Navy, aboard ships or being transported by ships to get from point A to point B, don't know what it's like to live in a confined space for an extended period of time. So share with us some of your memories, that's a good word, I like that, of being on board in tight quarters with a whole bunch of people that you've gone through basic with, and you've developed now this rapport, kind of like a brotherhood almost. Oh, by the way, did you have any women on board at that time?
No.
Okay, so it was a brotherhood. I don't want to be sexist here, so it was a brotherhood. Describe, you know, basically traversing the ship to get on top of the deck, what the mess halls were like, that kind of stuff.
As you said, it was confined spaces.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that our bunk area was stacked 3 high and 3 wide, or 3 long.
3 long, okay.
And so there would have been 30 people.
Okay.
In our one little immediate area, which is quite a few people. But if you break it down, then you have a third of those on watch.
Mm-hmm.
And a third of them are working while you're, you know, so there was probably 10 or 15 people in that area at a given time. Okay. Not everybody was sleeping,
right,
you know, in there at the same time.
Right. So how did you guys handle your shipmates who had snoring problems?
Earplugs.
Ah, I love it. And then you guys ate in shifts, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The mess hall was open, it seemed like, all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was kind of a different eating experience.
Uh-huh.
Stand in line just like any place else in
like
the military.
Like a cafeteria, basically. Yeah.
And go through your deal and everything was in order.
Okay.
You know, kind of like a line.
Right. Now, when you're going through really, really rough seas, how does that affect eating in the mess? I mean, do they have a system where, you know, trays can be put in a space and on the table and it stays there? Or
the way that worked is your tray, you kind of held your tray in your hand.
Oh, okay.
While you ate, that way you could adjust your body to the ship.
Uh-huh.
And instead of trying to set it on the table and let it slide everywhere.
Yeah, right. I'm seeing all these trays of food flying around and people slipping on the floor and all that kind of stuff. So, good. There is a system designed for that.
Well, I mean, there was, like I said, just pretty much held on to it and with one hand and ate with the other.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Gotcha. What's the biggest seas that you were ever in on that ship? Do you remember?
I do remember. It was 1990. We went through Hurricane Hugo, mm-hmm. which was the worst hurricane before Katrina.
Right, yeah.
We were off the southern Atlantic coast, and it was 120-foot waves.
Holy moly, that's like a 12-story building.
Exactly.
Dang.
But the most peaceful spot I ever been in my life was in the eye of it.
Oh, yeah.
It was smooth, sun shining.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just enough, you know, we turned around and it was rode to the eye long enough to get everything back in order.
Yeah.
Get it untwisted from the 2 days prior.
No doubt, yeah.
But to go from really crazy seas.
Uh-huh.
To nice calm, and then it was really crazy again.
Yeah.
It was no leading up to it. When you come out of the eye, it was the same as when you went into the eye.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow. That's nuts. Now, during those really rough seas, did you guys ever lose anybody overboard?
No.
Very good. Yeah, you know, I know it does happen from time to time.
It does happen.
Yeah. Well, that's a good record to have. For sure. So, as a member of the North Atlantic Fleet, what were your travels? I mean, did you ever make it over to Europe, Middle East, that kind of stuff? Or
we did. I've been to Puerto Rico,
mm-hmm.
6 or 7 of the Virgin Islands,
mm-hmm.
France, Spain, Italy, Egypt, Africa for 1 day, and Israel,
mm-hmm.
the Mediterranean.
Okay. You got to do the Mediterranean cruise.
I did.
Very cool. So was it interesting to get off the ship, you know, take shore leave and kind of get out and see different cultures and stuff like that?
Very much so.
Yeah.
It was a shell shock again.
Yeah.
Coming from rural California to now you're in Italy where the streets are 9 feet wide and they're driving 2 cars by it.
Crazy.
A lot of mopeds,
uh-huh.
you know, so the mobility kind of continued.
Right.
Smaller vehicles.
Yep, yep. Little shoebox cars, I call them. Of all the countries that you were in, which cuisine did you enjoy the most?
That's a tough question.
Okay.
Because there was several different places where I liked.
Yeah.
I would have to say France had some interesting food.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's cool. So you got a little California boy, got exposed to, you know, international cuisine.
Exactly.
Right, right. Well, that's good. Okay, so, you know, you've basically done your tour. How long were you in the Navy?
Just shy of 4 years.
Okay. So that was a full enlistment. For, you know, yourself and most of the guys, unless they re-upped, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Now, I'm sure you got an opportunity to re-up.
I did.
Uh-huh.
And probably would have.
Yeah.
Had I not been in love.
Ooh.
Needed to come home.
The love bug. All right. And is that your current person? Okay.
No, like I said, I wish I had now.
So that love interest didn't work out. But that's okay. I mean, I'm on number three, so what can I say? All right, so you get discharged. Where did they, back in Norfolk, where you got your discharge papers?
I did.
Okay.
I got discharged right before Earth Day.
Okay.
So I was able to go to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
and experience the 1.5 million people in Washington, D.C. on Earth Day.
Another shell shock.
Yes.
So you're in Washington, D.C. during Earth Day. Any particular memories of that day other than like, wow?
Pretty much the wow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that many people was mind-blowing how you could get them in one spot.
Yeah. And from what I understand, most Earth Days don't have a lot of controversy, so it was probably pretty peaceful and everybody was relatively well-behaved and all that kind of stuff, so...
A lot of walking.
Yeah.
You know, there was not so much, couldn't whistle a cab.
Yeah. So did you take in any of the national monuments when you were back there?
I did.
Yeah.
It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, lots of history, I'll tell you. It's crazy stuff. So how did you get transported? I'm assuming you came back to California.
I did.
Yeah.
They gave me some money, and instead of flying, I rode the bus just because I wanted to be a little more experienced.
Right. So another chance for difference.
Growth. And
changes. Yeah, excellent. Well, by the time you get back to California, you got to be a pretty well-rounded individual, realizing that there's this whole big planet out there and lots of different folks, even in just our own country.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Did that change your way that you related to people after that at all, or...
I would have to say yes.
Uh-huh.
Let me be a little more open-minded and not quite so judgmental.
Gotcha.
Right off the bat, you know, give people a chance.
Right, right. Yeah, that's one thing they say about travel is it really helps broaden one's horizons on other people's realities and cultures and things like that. So I have not been out of the United States. I've barely been out of California and Oregon. So maybe I'll have to do that. I've got a motorcycle that says it's time for a road trip.
Hey, that sounds pretty fun.
Yeah, definitely. So when you came back to the West Coast, where did you end up? Was it back in Susanville?
It was back in Susanville.
Okay, because that's where kind of family is at this point, right?
Yes.
Okay. What did you do as far as getting a job then?
I worked at a door core mill.
Door core?
Making solid door cores.
Okay, yeah.
So it was low key.
Right. Yeah. Factory, you know, piece work kind of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, good deal. How many years did you spend over there?
About four.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then where did you go to?
I moved to Oregon.
Hey. Now we're in Oregon. What year is that? Do you remember? Rough.
I would have to say it was 98.
Okay. So we're getting pretty current, you know, within the next 20 years. Cool. Now, did you end up in Brookings at that time or different area of Oregon?
No, I met my wife in Susanville.
Okay.
And her folks lived in Rouge outside of Jacksonville.
Right.
So moved over there.
Okay.
And lived with them for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that whole area, the Applegate Valley and stuff like that, it's got a lot of history to it, you know, early settlers and the Applegate Trail and all that kind of stuff. So were you...
And then it also has mining.
Yeah, mining.
Hey, that's where I was
going to say, I was bringing it back to, did you get involved with any of the activities there? So... Yeah, once a gold panner, always a gold panner.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Did you actually find some decent ore beds or strikes or whatever?
Found a few nuggets, but Nothing that I could retire off of
yet. Yeah, right. And, you know, it's like they say, half the adventure is just getting out and doing it. It's not necessarily striking it big. But, you know, when you do get that little nugget in the pan, it's like, wow, you know.
Exactly.
It's like hooking a fish, you know, on the end of the line. It's like, wow. So that's cool. Now, is that something that you and your wife did together? Or
no, just me personally.
Yeah. The solitude individual out there in the wilds panning and communing with nature, I guess, is the best way to put it, because you're out in the middle of everything.
Exactly.
Yeah, all the birds. And did you ever see any large animals while you were doing your mining stuff?
Oh, I've seen several bears, some elk, deer. So the wildlife is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you're prospecting, you're kind of quiet.
Right.
So they pretty much find you versus you finding them.
Yeah. It's not like you're making a whole bunch of noise and scaring them off. So that makes it nice. Okay. Well, with that note of the tranquility of mining in the Applegate Valley, we're going to take a break for a little station ID. And you are listening to KCIWLP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in Brookings, Oregon. And I want to encourage anybody that might want to learn a little bit more about radio, how it works. We're always looking for volunteers for the station here. So feel free to go on to our Facebook account or kciw.org. And there's some links to apply for volunteer positions or submit ideas for other radio programming too, which is really nice. So now we're back, and we're talking about being in Oregon, being in Rouge with your wife. This is the current one we're talking about?
Yes.
All right, Miss Katrina. I work with Katrina on the food bank board, and she's just a wonderful person. So how did you guys meet?
Through a mutual friend.
Mm-hmm.
It was back before I even went into the military.
Really? That long, huh? So you kept in communication while you were in the military, or?
I worked for our mutual friend's dad.
Okay.
In high school. And she just happened to be visiting one time. And was like, hi, I'm Bill. I'm Katrina. And just went like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then years went by. I got out of the service. And lo and behold, his mutual friend said, hey, look who's around.
Miss Katrina. So was it a love at first sight thing, or was it something that's developed over time as good friends?
For myself, it's been a love at first sight.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'll get the story from her later on. All right. So when did you eventually end up in the Brookings area?
2008.
Okay. So between Rouge and Brookings, were there other locations that you guys lived in?
Yeah, there was.
Uh-huh. Okay. Sounds good. Now you guys are over in Brookings, 2009. What brought you over here, out of curiosity?
Her folks, her mom was born here.
Mm-hmm.
And family has had a homestead since the 1800s.
Right.
So they've been a long time residents of the county.
Right, yeah. They're part of the Native American influence here in this area. So, yeah, I understand the connections to that. And I hope to explore that a little bit more on the radio show. But that's another topic.
It is.
So when you got out here, what did you end up doing as far as employment goes?
I was working for Casey McLennan at the Dayton Rock.
Okay.
Equipment operator.
Yeah, I pass that every day going up and down North Bank where I live. Cool deal. And what kind of job were you doing with them?
Loader operator.
Loader operator. Okay. That's an interesting operation. I mean, you know, I've seen that hillside kind of like, you know, come down over the years. Who is the person that is up on the top with the big, you know, tractor, scoop, whatever it is? I'm going, that's got to be like a nerve-wracking job.
I've done that before.
Have you? So, I mean, what do you have to be watching for up there? I mean, I'm assuming that whole hillside is fairly stable.
It is.
Okay. So, but I'm sure there's been some hairy moments up there, too.
There has been.
Yeah. Why don't you describe one of them to us? Because people that see that and they'll see the cat up on the hillside, you know, they may not realize how dangerous or potentially dangerous that job can be.
It's probably when we were moving a lot of the overburden to get to the rock, there was quite a bit of dirt.
Right.
And one of the most memorable for myself was actually watching the cat come off the edge and go down the pile.
Oh, wow.
I mean, it was safe, but nonetheless, it was
hairy.
Exactly.
Not something you'd want to do necessarily every day of the week.
Exactly.
Holy moly. Crazy. So you went from basically kind of heavy equipment operator. Are you still doing that today?
Or? I'm not. I've been working concrete construction.
Oh, okay.
So traveling.
Right. So you get to put a little road time in from job to job.
I had.
Yeah. Are you involved in basically just the construction aspect, or are you like a supervisorial position, or you get involved in the bidding aspect of things?
I've just been on the building part.
The building part. Okay. So that's forms and pouring and finishing and
yes.
the whole,
yes.
whole thing. That's an art form into itself. I mean, I've seen some really great, you know, cement jobs, and I've seen some really lousy ones. So hopefully we can call your work into the former category of that. What's one of the biggest jobs you had to pour for?
We just recently finished doing a job here for Pacific Laminate in Brookings.
Mm-hmm.
It was been about an 18-month job.
Wow.
Rebuilding their fuel shed and their maintenance building.
Gotcha.
With the biggest job being the 10-foot deep footings.
Wow. So those are all up to seismic code and all that kind of stuff, I imagine.
They are.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just a lot of concrete.
No kidding. Yeah. Wow. And I mean, concrete's measured in cubic yards. I mean, it's like, how many cubic yards per footing are we talking about, basically?
Oh, we were pouring hundreds of yards a day.
Jeez. So you were getting trucks in from not only our local plants, but probably across the border?
They were coming from pretty much Tidewater.
Tidewater, right. I know they've got a plant down in Crescent City and one here. So kept them busy for a while.
Yes, kept us busy also.
Well, it's really interesting because most people don't realize that, you know, you'll see the construction going on in areas, but how many people are actually employed with the company that's basically doing the construction, but also all the allied kind of, like the concrete pouring. I mean, that's like subbed out to a bidder, and Tidewater got that contract. And you know, it's not always Tidewater, but, you know, a lot of times they come in the least expensive, and that's what you need to get the job done. So you're actually a huge driver of the economy locally by, you know, supporting those kinds of businesses. So, yeah, there's more behind the scenes than most people realize. Yeah.
There are.
Yeah, cool deal. Any mishaps or funny stories about pouring concrete?
None, really.
That's too bad. I was hoping maybe you fell in and left a butt print somewhere. You see it on TV all the time, but that's, I'm sure, you know, just for gag purposes. But it's a lot of hard work, you know. Do you operate the large machines that go out and skim the surface to finish it off? Or
no, but I have seen those.
Mm-hmm.
And my co-worker Walt Nelson is a really good concrete finisher.
Mm-hmm.
He does most of the finishing.
Yeah, gotcha. So 18 months, man, that's a long time on one job. I mean, it's a great job security.
It was, and nothing better than working local.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it makes you, allows you to be at home at night and stuff like that. So.
Exactly.
So speaking of home, how'd you like that segue? You guys live off of Gardner Ridge.
We do.
Yeah. 2017, Checo Bar Fire. What was that experience like?
That experience was hell.
Yeah.
There was a lot of miscommunication and no resources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, there was fire trucks driving by my house every 20 minutes
mm-hmm.
with nobody stopping. So it was kind of nerve-wracking.
Yeah, that's got to be a real empty feeling of despair kind of thing to realize that you're not going to get the necessary help that you think that you need or you know.
Well, you know, we like to consider ourselves as self-reliant.
Right.
And we do have our own little fire truck,
mm-hmm.
little 250-gallon truck. It was enough to save my house.
You're right.
And with the work of the father-in-law and immediate family, we were able to save the house, but lost the ranch, barn.
Right, the
outbuildings. And other buildings.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, I live up off of Donald's Road, which is just this side of Loeb Park. And I was watching the fire come down the side of Mount Emily, and I knew the fire wouldn't reach me. They had set up a 10,000-gallon water tank with all sorts of, you know, equipment just in case. But it was the smoke that got to me and the dogs. I had to move down to Crescent City for a month. So how did you guys survive the smoke? Because I'm assuming that you stayed there. You didn't leave or anything.
I stayed there for the most part. But when it flashed and was crowning, driving through the flames to get out, was pretty impressive, you know, pretty mind-altering.
Well, yeah. Some people would call it, like, potential PTSD.
But then being back in the very first thing in the morning to stay in the smoke was pretty much hellish.
Yeah, yeah.
The wife and kids stayed in Smith River away from the smoke.
Right.
For the first 4 or 5 days, anyhow.
Right. Yeah, most people don't realize that at one time, the only clear air along the Oregon coast was either Seattle or San Francisco. Because we had so many fires going on in the state at one time, you know, not as big as the Checo Bar, but at any rate. So how's the rebuild coming along?
Oh, it's still in disarray.
Yeah. Any funding made available or potentially to be made available to help the homeowners out in that neck of the woods?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty much self-reliance.
Mm-hmm.
You just buckle up and take care of your own.
Yeah, yeah.
Try to help your neighbors when you can.
Yeah.
But
it takes a certain kind of individual to live in those conditions. Most city dwellers would probably fail within the first couple of days. You know, I'm kind of half in between, half, you know, that. Not to, to toot my horn, but I had a 2,000-gallon water tank that I donated to the residents up there. I don't know where it ended up, but I knew I was hanging on to it for some reason. And, you know, when you have your water tanks get melted, basically, you know, it's nice to have something that you can help people with. So, at any rate, so day to day up there, how are things regrowing? I mean, what kind of new sprouts and stuff have you guys seen?
Well, there is a lot of the tan oak mm-hmm. is growing back, which I don't know if you want the tan oak or the hardwoods. I myself would like to keep them.
Yeah.
Because firs like grass.
Yeah.
It'll grow anywhere, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, good. So, ferns are coming back?
It's growing back.
Yeah.
It'll never be like it was, but it's
still home.
That's exactly still home.
And I imagine you guys have still got those same, you know, panoramic views that you had before the fire, just without trees. How did the kids do through this whole thing?
My kids have really taken it hard.
Yeah.
My son is truly PTSD.
Yeah. It's one of those things that I find it very frustrating that, first of all, it happened. It could have been avoided, but that's, you know, water under the bridge. But there's no funding being made available for things like, because we're not talking about that many houses being destroyed. 7, 10, something like that.
I'm not exactly sure the number, but
yeah,
it's no more, you know, no more than 20.
Yeah, it's fairly low. So the cost to help rebuild outbuildings and structures would not be that great. Plus provide the necessary emotional support, psychological support to the survivors of the fires.
I myself believe where the funding needs to be.
Yeah.
Is the mental health and possibly the physical health, because who knows what kind of long-term effect the smoke and the other toxins that were put out there might be,
sure,
might create.
Sure. Do you guys, because I know there's kind of a group that's gotten together, do you guys have any input to our county commissioners about that kind of stuff or state representatives?
I know that there has been some work in that direction,
uh-huh,
but I'm not keen on the details.
Right. Okay. Well, we all know that the wheels of government turn extremely slowly, unless it's in their vested interest to help somebody out. We are the stepchild under the stairs in Curry County here, so that's one strike against us. Two is we're talking about not a huge number of voting people that a politician can say, oh, if I help these people out, this will bolster my chances for re-election. Yeah, it's just tough. And I know that from who I've talked to in the past, their opinion of government has seriously eroded after this whole debacle with regards to the fire. So at any rate, so you guys are hanging in there.
Yes.
Okay. Ever think of moving?
No.
Okay. I'm sure there's been some discussions.
Actually, believe it or not, there hasn't been.
Really? Well, that's a commitment to the land and to the family and what you've created up there. So more power to you. Helps make things a little bit clearer when you're making decisions about your future. So that's really good. One of the last segments of the show I wanted to talk to you about is Brookings in general, Curry County kind of thing, the best and worst. You came over here, and there must have been something that attracted you to the area to want to stay. I know family is a big thing. So what are some of the positives about Brookings and Curry County that you can speak to?
The location.
Yeah. Location, location, location. Yeah.
I like the fact that I can travel a half hour to the south and be in the majestic redwoods, and travel a half hour north and be at the Rogue River.
Mm-hmm.
And all along the coast, there's not one spot you can't pull off the road and see the ocean and the waves and the Pinnacle Rocks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Plus, you can do some gold painting, too, and fishing. So you've got the outdoor aspect of the area that is really beautiful. I watched a PBS special on the legislation for the wild and scenic rivers that goes back many decades, and how rivers have gotten added to it. And, you know, the Rogue is on there, and the Smith is on there, and I think the Checo is proposed to be on there, you know, for all that kind of stuff. So we really are lucky and spoiled to be in such a beautiful area. And I know I try to appreciate it every day driving into town. It's like, man, I've had some commutes in my life that really stink, but this is like the most beautiful thing. All I got to do is watch out for little critters on the road or the deer, at night, you know, and during dusk, but it's really nice. Negative things about the area. What would you like to see changed? If you had your wish.
If I had my wish, probably a few more things for the young people.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much to do around here for youngsters. They did away with the bowling alley, and there's one little skate park.
Right. The roller rink, you know, was gone a number of years ago. You know, that was kind of a fun indoor activity.
That would be my number one deal, would a place for kids to be and go and hang out safely.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I know for myself, my son likes to ride his bicycle, and it's a trek to go all the way to Grants Pass.
Where they've got the BMX.
To go to the BMX track.
Yeah, they've been talking about a BMX park up here for a long time. I don't know the history of it and where it lies right now, but that to me would seem to be a really nice addition. I know they just got done spending a considerable amount of money on the baseball fields, which is great. So maybe now we can focus from, you know, sports and, well, BMX is a sport, but a different form of sport than most people are, you know, realizing. We've got Frisbee golf, you know, why not BMX? Yeah, that would be really cool. And hopefully get it built maybe before your son's worked out of the BMX phase. If they ever do, I'm not sure. Because we got some BMXers there who are in their 30s now, so they're still out there riding professionally. How about the infrastructure here, like medical care and law enforcement and things like that? What's your take on those? And it's time to be honest. It's okay. Nobody's going to hold it against you.
Yeah, the law enforcement seems to be all right.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little shorthanded at times, and especially in the rural areas.
Right.
But that's to be expected also.
Right. There comes that self-sufficiency kind of thing.
Exactly.
Right. And we've all seen those signs. My home is protected by Smith & Wesson. And sometimes you just have to be that way when you're in a remote area and there's no help that's available for an hour or more, you know, kind of stuff. It makes it tough.
Just have to be vigilant is all.
Right.
What's going on around you.
Yeah. Be aware. Be aware. Situationally aware is what they call it. So how about medical care? Have you guys had to interact much with medical care?
There, and that would be another big issue, mm-hmm. probably for Curry County, is medical care.
Mm-hmm.
Brookings being halfway between both hospitals, so
right.
Which way do you go? Into California, or do you go to Gold Beach if you get hurt or are sick?
Yeah.
I know that they have a little health, Fifth Street Health here.
Well, I will add that they have opened up a 24-hour emergency room now, an official standalone emergency room. So that's a step in the right direction. We can say yay for that. And my brother-in-law took advantage of that about a month and a half ago, and I was impressed. I used to work in a hospital, so I come in with a different way to look at things. So we're getting there.
Now, with that said, a standalone, does that mean you have to stand up if you go to the emergency room? Or
no, they have comfortable chairs you can sit in. Yeah, but I mean, it's more than just a cough, cold, bump, scrape, urgent care facility. This is in-depth. They've got all the equipment to do heart monitoring and, you know, all the necessary stuff so that they can stabilize before they transport to one facility or another. So that's kind of nice, but room for improvement definitely is needed. Yeah. How about other stuff in the area that you would like to see happen? We got the kids. We got the medical.
I pretty much am happy.
Yeah. Satisfied with where things are. I mean, it, after all, it is a small community. We don't have a lot of people here, you know, so our tax base to support new stuff is relatively limited. Overall, despite the controversies of the infighting within the government, I think we're doing a pretty decent job.
Yes.
You know, there's always room for improvement.
Exactly.
It's like, you know, I'm sure you experienced that in the Navy. No matter how good a job you did, there's always room for improvement. So Any last things you'd like to share with us before we bring this interview to a conclusion?
No, nothing really, other than a shout out to my beautiful wife.
Hey, hey, Miss Katrina. Well, good deal. Yeah, she's a real go-getter, and I look forward to working on with her on some projects for the food bank and for some other things I've gotten in the works. So that sounds good. Well, Bill, I really want to thank you for being here today. I know it was kind of last minute, but hopefully it wasn't too painful.
No,
and, no, and you had an enjoyable time, and we got to know you a little bit better from, you know, just being willing to talk on the radio. So we will be seeing each other, I'm sure, you know, especially if you hang out with Miss Katrina at events off and on. So, and I, every time I go by Gardner Ridge, I think about you guys up there, you self-sufficient fire survivors. Yeah, it's a tough thing. So anyway, I hope you have a great rest of the day. And I'm going to say, I am looking for some female veterans for this show. So far, we've been having all guys. So please, if you have an interest, know of a female veteran that would like to be on the radio show, have them give me a call at 541-254-1002. Or you can text me at that number as well. I really think that the females go underrepresented in this county in a lot of ways. I have an open platform for having you all on the show. Okay? So without any further ado, this is Jim Newman with our veteran community on KCIW Radio 100.7 on your FM dial. Hope you have a great rest of your listening day. Until next time.
The opinions expressed here were those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in the program.